I think I've turned it off, but it's all a bit. It's all every time it does, it pings. I obviously have got my sound on, so I can hear you guys.
Did you get a message from one of your colleagues saying, "Do not go on the podcast. Whatever you do, it's going to end your career."
That's a good shout. Yeah. Did you hear that ping that just came up?
I did. That was another warning. Can you just turn the volume down? I guess.
Well, no. Then I won't be able to hear you.
Italian Wine Podcast. Chin Chin with Italian Wine People.
Hello, this is the Italian Wine Podcast with me, Monty Walden. My guest today is Ian Harris. Ian is the Chief Executive of the WSET, which is the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. Ian, welcome. Very pleased to have you on the show.
Delighted to be here.
Where can we start? You have an incredibly interesting career. How did you get into wine? How did you end up where you are?
Interesting is a good way of describing it. I mean, it's been a really enjoyable career so far. It's 43 years. And I started because I did French at university, and my intention when I went to university was to become a teacher. So it's slightly ironic that I've come full circle into an organization that is involved in education. But I lived in, as part of my degree course, the third year of the four-year course was spent abroad, and I was very keen to continue playing rugby. So my tutor said, well, you better apply for a position down in the southwest of France, which I did. And so I ended up being an assistant teacher at a school just south of Bordeaux. Got involved in wine, as in tasting it, because I had a real sort of light bulb moment that made me realize that this is the industry I wanted to get into. One of my fellow teachers at the school invited me for dinner, one of her friends who owned a vineyard in Sauternes. I went along to this dinner. This is about sort of 3 weeks into arriving in France. And it was just the most wonderful experience of my life. Arrived at this vineyard. It was October, still quite warm. Fantastic dinner. We went out into the vineyard, and the vineyard owner cooked entrecote steaks over a fire made from the vine cuttings, which were still lying in the vineyard. We went back into the house at about midnight and had some Sauternes with dessert, which completely opened my eyes to the world of wine. And that morning, the next morning when I got back to my apartment, I wrote to my mum and said, I'm not too sure about education. The wine trade seems far more fun. And that was it. Here I am, four decades plus later.
Okay. So basically it was sort of hands-on experience in wine that made you, that has shaped your career.
Yeah, it was really. And when I looked to see how you get into the wine business, because it was something I didn't really know much about, it was a friend of mine who I played cricket with who had an account with a couple of the fine wine merchants in the West End of London, who said to me, well, I can bring along a price list with an address and a phone number, and why don't you just write to them and ask if they got any jobs? And that's exactly what I did. I wrote one letter to one company, as a result of which I had one interview, and at the end of 1 hour, I was offered a job, which I took. Very lowly job, working in the cellars of a West End wine merchant, but it got my foot on the ladder. So I didn't get in through a graduate trainee scheme or anything like that.
Who was the wine merchant?
It was a company called Christopher & Company, who sadly no longer exist. Their proud boast was that they were the oldest wine merchant in London, so old that their records had been burnt in the Great Fire of London, so they didn't know quite how old they were. But if that was true, that would have made them older than Berry Brothers, who currently claim to be the oldest wine merchant in London.
So you got into it through the sort of atmospheric side, the love of it, and then you getting into the business side. You did have quite an interesting career working for that particular wine merchant, but then you worked for a multinational. Which was that, and how did you get involved with them?
Yeah, that was Seagram. So Seagram, big multinational wine and spirit company based in America, originally founded in Canada. And Seagram was one of the top four multinational wine and spirit companies. And after 10 years working in the sort of traditional wine side of life, by then I was, what, 32, and I thought, actually, I really do need to get big company experience. So I went to an agency, and I was on the sales side, so I was able to basically put myself up as a potential national account manager. So I was interviewed by one company called Hedges & Butler, which was part of Bass, the big brewer. And then in between one interview with them and the second interview, the agency put me up for a job with Seagram. And I had a first interview, second interview, and third interview with Seagram. So I joined Seagram as a national account manager, looking after one of their biggest accounts, which was IDV, which was the forerunner to what's now Diageo.
International Distillers and Vintners.
Indeed, indeed. Yes.
All those names are a real blast from the past to some people listening to, a lot of people listening to this podcast. But in their day, although they were sort of household names if you had anything to do with the liquor trade. So before your current job, you taught the spirit sections of the diploma at the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. How did you jump from the kind of the shop floor, the you know, pounding the pavement and calling on people to buy your kit, so to speak, whether it's spirits or wine? How did you get into the educational side?
Well, it was more that I was only on the sales side for about a year and a half at Seagram. I then moved into the marketing team as brand manager on Martell Cognac, because I spoke fluent French, so I'd got some marketing experience in my previous role. So I came out of the sales side, and as you said, pounding the pavement. So I became a bit of a product expert on cognac, because I was running the brand in the UK, and then moved into a global role with Martell, which was owned by Seagram. And I just thought I knew a fair bit about cognac. So I approached the WSET, this is back in 1990, to say, if ever you need someone to teach about brandy in general, but cognac in particular, give me a shout. I think I know quite a bit about it. And a couple of weeks later, I got a letter in those days back saying, we've got a vacancy for someone to teach about spirits on diploma. Would you be available to do it? So I did. So it was again, a sort of fortuitous letter at the right time. So I started teaching the spirits side of the diploma from 1990, pretty much every year until Seagram was taken over in 2001, with the exception of the 2 years when I was working in France on the global Martell job. So it was a sort of natural fit, really, that I knew a lot about cognac, still do, and it was an opportunity for me to pass that on. And I, as I said to you at the very beginning, I originally wanted to be a teacher, so it came fairly naturally to me.
I was one of your students, by the way.
God, yeah.
I've been waiting to let you know that. I thought, how long can I let him go before I?
Well, I tell you what, Monty, the acid test is, did you pass?
I did.
Well, there you go. So that means I must have been a really good teacher.
You were. You were fantastic. Still remember your lectures.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say so. And I'm glad you've only just told me that. Yeah. Okay.
So what was the next step then?
Well, when Seagram was taken over by, ironically, Diageo, which was a company that I knew pretty well. So Seagram was taken over by Diageo and Pernod Ricard in 2001. I was a director of Seagram UK, and we were told very early on in the takeover process that Pernod Ricard UK, who were taking over our business unit, wouldn't require the services of many, indeed, if any, people from Seagram, and certainly not the directors. So I knew quite early on that I was going to be made redundant by the new owners of Seagram. So I started looking around to see what I should do. I was 46. All my friends in the business said, oh, you'll have no problem. You know, everybody knows you. You've got sales experience. You've got marketing experience. You'll just walk into another job. Well, the phone wasn't exactly ringing off the hook with job offers. And then I found out that the role of chief exec of the WSET was going to come up fairly, probably pretty much around the time that I was going to be made redundant. So I just started the ball rolling and started to talk to one of the board of trustees, because the WSET obviously is a charitable trust, and started the ball rolling. And I had an interview just before Christmas, so December 2001. Was offered the job in January 2002 and started in April 2002, which is pretty much the time that Seagram was being taken over. So again, all the stars aligned for me. That's a bit of a facet of my life. I always seem to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, but you make your own luck. That's the trick. But did they see you both, obviously, as an excellent communicator, you know, for whoever, you know, whether you're communicating with salespeople or lesser members of the wine trade, just getting into their first job maybe and having to do the WSET exams, almost sort of under duress. But it was not just your communication skills, it was also your business skills, I would imagine, that were sort of like a perfect fit for them. Don't be modest.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. I think the thing that clinched it, I think, for me and for the people who gave me this job, and it's the most wonderful job in the world, is that I am absolutely passionate about the power of education, both for people who work in the industry who want to better themselves, but also for the industry as a whole, because the more people understand about wines and spirits, whether they're consumers or the person selling it or promoting it at the point of sale, the more people understand about the wines and spirits which they're going to consume, the more they'll be prepared to pay, the more they'll be prepared to experiment. So my big soapbox when I joined the WSET, and the reason why they gave me the job in the first place, was that it felt I could convince the global industry about the value of education and treating education as an investment, both in your people and also in your business. And one of the first things I did when I joined WSET was to undertake a study with a company called Unwins, who you will probably remember, Monty, sort of a high street off-license chain. And we did a test with them, really, to show the value of education and how, if you've got a WSET qualification when you're working at the front end of a wine shop, how you can actually trade people up and therefore put money on the bottom line. So that's really what my main mantra has been for the last 18 years since I took over.
Okay, then it's interesting what you say about Unwins, which was kind of, obviously people offshore won't have ever heard of them, but it wasn't the most famous of wine merchants or chains of wine merchants in the United Kingdom, which is a huge consumer of wine and has been for about eight or nine centuries. How exactly was that trial set up? What you know, so that the way that you gauged exactly the uptick in sales because of the staff being more educated and probably more enthused.
Yeah, I mean, what we did, we took 30 of their stores, and this was a joint initiative between us and Unwins. I knew the marketing director of Unwins, and at the time they were desperate for any sort of publicity because they were struggling. So we basically cooked up this idea. We took 30 of their stores. We cut them in half with demographics. So you had one store in a particular area with a particular demographic, and then another store in a different area but with a very, very similar demographic. And then what we did, so basically we took 30 stores, cut them in half, so 15 stores on one side of the paper, 15 on the other, both so with matching demographics. We then put one half of them through a WSET, just a level one, a foundation level wine program, and the others we didn't, so we left them untrained. We measured EPOS data before and after the training had taken place, and there was a very significant uplift once people had had just a basic induction into wine that they were able to trade people up. I actually myself went into a couple of Unwin stores just to sort of test the water, even before we'd got the test in place. And I actually went into an Unwin store on the south coast of England, and the guy managed to trade me down, which is a pretty good achievement. I went in there saying, I'd like to buy an Australian Shiraz, and I literally picked up a bottle of Aussie Shiraz at about $12.99. He should have said, "Thank you very much, sir. Give me your money. Wrap it up. Off you go." He said, "Oh no. We've got one on promotion at $7.99." So the manager managed to trade me down from an expensive bottle to a cheapish bottle. So that convinced me that there was a job to be done. But it was a piece of research that we did, and we still use it today, to be honest. It's still one of the best pieces of research to show that education adds value to your business.
Okay, it's very interesting to hear that about the trading down. It's kind of, I don't know if that's kind of like a British kind of trait where I don't know why, but we are a little bit like that sometimes. But
yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, a little knowledge goes a long way. I mean, that's the other thing, that you don't need to be a master of wine to have enough knowledge to be able to convince somebody to spend a little bit more on a bottle of wine or a glass of wine.
How has wine education changed at all levels in the modern era, both in terms of, you know, we can get almost any wine from any part of the world at any time of day or night, plus, of course, social media and the fact that we can communicate with anybody across the world at a flick of a switch. How has that affected or enhanced the potential of wine education?
I think it's enhanced it, to be honest, because the fact that there are so many wines available, and the UK is, as you said, you know, we've for nine centuries and more, we've been a great consumer of wine, and the UK is still very much the shop window of the world's wine. And if you take the number of countries making wine, it's hellishly confusing. And I know that, you know, we're here on the Italian Wine Podcast. You know, Italy is about as confusing as it gets for a lot of people. So education actually takes on a much more important role when people are being exposed to different products from different areas, different grape varieties or different regions. If I go back to 40 years ago in the UK, certainly, you know, you went into an off license because most people weren't dealing with fine wine merchants, and you bought brands. You know, you bought Carida or Carrion or anything else beginning with a C, which you hadn't a clue where it came from, but it sort of tasted okay. So that was the real thin end of the wedge, and now we're at a fascinating stage in the wine industry, whereas there's so much really great wine coming out of different countries that you'd never believe could even produce wine. And obviously England's up there with the best now. So education actually takes on an even more importance when you're dealing with a market that is so complicated.
I mean, in terms of the COVID situation at the moment, how has that affected, or how has it enhanced online learning?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been, we closed our school in London in mid-March, and most of our providers around the world, including in Italy, actually, we've got 15 schools in Italy running WCT courses. And well, you'll know how hard Italy was hit. So when the lockdown happened around the world, that really put the mockers on all classroom-based courses and indeed physical examinations. We already had an online educational offering, which was pretty good, but relatively small as a percentage of our business. But what we did when lockdown happened and our business really hit the floor with physical courses not taking place, was we fast-tracked what's called remote invigilation. So this is where you can do an exam now from the comfort of your own home on your own device, or on your own computer, or on your own phone. But because our qualifications are regulated, so they're in the UK framework of qualifications, there has to be an invigilation. You can't just do an online course, fill out the questions, press send, and 10 seconds later you get the result. We have to be assured that the person doing the exam is the person who is supposed to be doing it. So we fast-tracked a system called remote invigilation, which is where you're filmed completing the exam. This is on the multiple choice ones, and you have to set up your phone as a second camera to check that nobody's walking in the room, that you're not cheating, you haven't got an earphone in your ear with someone giving you the answers. So this is something that we fast-tracked. We were planning to introduce it later in 2020, but we fast-tracked it really because it was going to be the only game in town. So in May, we introduced it, and it's still, even now, it's about 25% of the people doing a WCT qualification are doing their exam at home on their own device, with their exam being invigilated by this system called remote invigilation. And it will be a game changer for us going forward, particularly in countries like USA. And then we've now got a complete end-to-end digital offering. So not just digital education and online examinations, but we've also just introduced ebooks 3 months ago. So you don't even have to get off your chair to answer the door for someone to deliver a book to you. So it's a complete end-to-end digital offering. And it really does open up lots of opportunity for us, particularly in countries like USA.
When you go back to that time in Bordeaux where you sort of got the bug for the drinks industry, did you ever imagine you would end up being, you know, the head of the most important wine education system in the on the planet?
No, I didn't actually. And to be totally honest, when I joined the trade back in 1977 and did one of the first things that happened was my boss sent me on a WCT course, which I did and passed it, and then did the next one and passed it, and then did the diploma and at the second attempt passed it. I'm not sure I would have wanted to be the head of WCT in those days because it was pretty sleepy. It was very UK focused, well, entirely UK focused. And it was only really when I could see the potential for wine and spirit education that it suddenly dawned on me that actually this would be a wonderful job to get. But certainly no, not in those early days. I was thinking more, to be honest, when I was thinking about going to the wine business, of having my own business, doing a bit of import, export. But of course now I know that that's a fantastic way to lose a bucket load of money, because you know the classic phrase of how do you make a small fortune in the wine trade, start with a big fortune. So no, I had no thought that I might be heading up this wonderful organization, which I now do.
Yeah, you know, your story about when you went, you're a young lad and you went to Bordeaux, that's exactly how I started in the wine trade as well. So because my French was terrible, and I had a French lady who was my French teacher, and she basically said, I don't want to see you next term. I was at boarding school. She said, don't come back unless you've spent time in France. And to cut a long story short, one of my mates who actually sat next to me in school, he said, well, listen, why don't you come down to Bordeaux, because my parents have links there, and ended up getting a job with a courtier en vin, which is like a middleman.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. The Bordeaux industry wouldn't work without them, would it?
And, you know, I was mowing lawns and doing all that sort of stuff, but I learned a lot. And, you know, when you talk about the power of education, my dad was a headmaster as well. I just think it's great that our industry has got this educational side to itself. I mean, a lot of members of the public love wine and they drink it every single day, obviously in moderation. But being able to pass on the right knowledge at the right time in the right way to a person who could become a lifelong shareholder, if you like, in Planet Wine, I just think is absolutely fantastic. I really do. I just the knowledge that you earn and that you gain is never ever wasted. I'm sure you'd agree with that.
I would, yeah. And it's also a sort of socially acceptable thing to be able to talk about, isn't it? And I'm sure you get it, Monty, when you're meeting friends and they probably shove a glass in front of your nose and go on in, smart ass, what's that? You know, so it's something that everybody wants to talk about it. And it is such a lovely subject. And it's also a subject that is changing on a daily, yearly basis.
What changes do you think our industry will see in the next coming years, either at the production level or the education level or any kind of level?
I think at the retail level there's going to be more people buying wines online. I think that's a sort of 21st century trend, that people are going to look for knowledge online and they're going to buy online. The experiential of going to a restaurant or a wine, maybe even a wine merchant, to actually taste is still important. But the value of education, I don't think, diminishes. People want to know why they should pay, or why they're being asked to pay £20 for a bottle versus a bottle that's made from the same grape variety that's half the price. But I think there's going to be consolidation at the production level, certainly. So smaller producers will probably be looking to all get together. But there's always going to be the space for the little wine merchant who is really proactive and sells. The little wine producer that sells through the cellar door, which effectively is the way that online can happen without having to give big margins to multiple retailers. So I think the retail environment's going to change. Whether you believe in climate change or not, I certainly believe the world is getting warmer. That's going to have an effect on the world in terms of production. We've already seen it in England. I think there's going to be an element of survival of the fittest, though. As with anything, because of COVID, a lot of businesses that aren't sharp and aren't smart just might go out of business, because it's a very, very competitive market in the wine business, and the world is still producing more wine than it can drink, so that means it's a very, very competitive market.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the production side. I also think the logistics side as well will change. I mean, partly also to do with climate change. I know wine obviously can last in bottle. It's not a perishable product in the sense of yogurt or anything like that, but I think we're seeing also hiccups in production cycles as well, in terms of bad weather. And so you're not always going to get the same brand every year, the top growth or just an everyday one.
But I think that's what, for me, that's part of the fascination, you know, buying, I'm not going to mention any brands by name, but if you buy one of these big brands, and the whole point is that it tastes the same year after year. Well, that's pretty boring, actually. I love the vintage variation or any variation that comes through a winemaker doing something a bit different with different blends, or indeed, you know, different ways of making wine. I think it's such a fascinating industry, and people want to learn about it because it is constantly changing.
And on that note, a perfect segue to say goodbye to my guest today, Ian Harris, WSET Chief Executive and my former teacher. It's very, very nice to hear your voice again, reminiscing about some of those old names from London and the early 90s wine merchants that no longer exist. Really fascinating to talk to you, and I really hope we can catch up again on the podcast at another...
I'd love to, because we're doing some really good stuff in Italy with 15 places you can do a WSET qualification, and Italy's absolutely flying for us in times of COVID. We're growing our business in Italy. So I'd be delighted to have another chat with you at some stage, Monty. Just let me know.
All right. Listen, it's really nice to talk to you, Ian. Take care, and best of luck with all your projects.
Brilliant. Thank you much.
Listen to the Italian Wine Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Himalaya FM, and more. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps cover equipment, production, and publication costs. Until next time, cin cin.